The first terrorist I interviewed was William Pierce, who's a very famous neo-Nazi. He's the guy who wrote the Turner Diaries, which is basically the Bible of the racist right. He wrote it under a pseudonym, Andrew McDonald. And it's really inspired in many ways a movement that's very active now, which is people who really want to either ignite or just hope to see a civil war. So that was my first terrorist.
Welcome. I'm Karen Greenberg, the host of Vital Interest Podcast, and that was Jessica Stern. Jessica Stern is a professor at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. She is the author of numerous books on terrorism, including Terrorism in the Name of God, published in 2005, and ISIS, The State of Terror, co-authored with J.M. Berger and published in 2015. Her most recent book is My War Criminal, Personal Encounters with an Architect of Genocide, published in 2020 based on a series of interviews with Radovan Karadzic. She is also a member of the Homeland Security Experts Group, an independent, nonpartisan group of Homeland Security policy and counterterrorism experts. Welcome, Jessica. Welcome to Vital Interest Podcast.
Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Today we talk about terrorism and rehabilitation and many other issues involved in the state of our world. So I wanted to start today, given that you've spent so many years thinking about terrorism, violent extremism, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Can you give me a sense of, now that you're involved in projects, thinking about how we deal with the legacy of the Al-Qaeda-ISIS period? Do you see this as something ongoing in the future? Do you think that we've come to the end of a period that was started by 9/11? How do you think about the arc and the shape of jihadist Islamist terrorism and what you had learned about it in your books?
I don't think we're at the end of jihadi terrorism. I think there's still a very heavy Al-Qaeda presence and ISIS presence in the region. And they still are important players in the world of terrorism. However, they have not been that successful at recruiting in the United States. Since 9/11, it's been very hard for them to get into the United States. And ISIS was basically a flop at trying to recruit in the United States. Muslims in the United States are very well integrated. They are better educated than the average American. They are more patriotic and they are wealthier. This is a very well integrated community.
I mean, one of the things that terrorism experts talk about and that you talked about as early as 2001 in your book, The Ultimate Terrorist, is the role that grievances play. These days, we hear the word grievances constantly when we're talking about terrorism, whether it's terrorism at home or terrorism abroad. Is this a useful word? And if it is, what are we really talking about? Are we talking about apples and oranges when it comes to one group versus another group, a local group versus a transnational group? Is it overused, or do you think it's really a good lens through which to look at the evolution of terrorism?
I think it is a good lens. I think the terrorists always claim to be acting in the name of a grievance, but I think there's a big difference between terrorists who are active in a war zone or in an occupied country, where many of the terrorists are actually paid. It may be a job. That's very different from the terrorist who gets mobilized in the West. Now, when we look at who is getting mobilized among white identity terrorists, we can see that their grievance, they have a very clear grievance, but it's often the push factors are often more important than the pull factors.
We just parse that out a little bit. Push factors, pull factors.
The grievance is often described as something outside the person, that it's something about the situation in the world that is upsetting to the person, that's what the terrorist wants to remedy. The terrorist sees an injustice and he or she wants to remedy that injustice. Whereas push factors are often more personal factors. There's something about the person's individual life that makes them a lot more prone to getting recruited. Why does the grievance story resonate with the individual? Often because something has happened to them to make them interested in violence in the name of an ideology. In a war zone, those personal factors are less important because there is very much a grievance. There's something terrible, absolutely terrible, no question about it, going on around the terrorist.
One of the things that's really special about the way you do your research is your interactions over decades with individuals who identify as terrorists or individuals who live inside communities that terrorists emerge from. That was unusual at the time, you know, in terms of the kind of academic research and lens that you apply to it. How did you get started doing that? Like, what was the impetus for it?
Well, yes, I did something very weird. I definitely wasn't trained to go out and talk to terrorists. The first thing that happened is I was writing my doctoral dissertation and I heard one lecture by Brian Jenkins, and I was completely fascinated. It was life-changing for me. After I heard that lecture, I thought, I have to work on terrorism. And I included a chapter on terrorism in a dissertation that was really about chemical weapons in Iraq. And that was it. I just got so curious. And I couldn't stop myself, even though I absolutely didn't have the training. I hadn't studied psychology or anthropology or sociology. Honestly, I spent a lot of time in Pakistan with individuals who were members of Pakistani jihadi groups when they were in Pakistan, members of Al-Qaeda when they were in Afghanistan. That's how they put it to me. It was completely crazy what I did. And I mean, it was something that you could do before 9/11, but it was not something you should do. I should not have done it.
What years are we talking?
The mid to late 90s. The first terrorist I interviewed was William Pierce, who's a very famous neo-Nazi. He's the guy who wrote the Turner Diaries, which is basically the Bible of the racist right. He wrote it under a pseudonym, Andrew McDonald. Timothy McVeigh was obsessed with this book. He was selling it at gun shows. He was giving it to all his friends. And it's really inspired in many ways a movement that's very active now, which is people who really want to either ignite or just hope to see a civil war, the accelerationists. So that was my first terrorist.
Brian Jenkins, who was at the time and still is a counterterrorism and terrorism expert working for RAND, writing these amazing reports still to this day, who's also now focused on domestic terrorism and what's happening in the white identity terrorism, as you called it, a community. And so I guess for you, there's not a real distinction in terms of understanding that these are people with grievances, some ideological, some tied to religion, or is it a mistake to sort of think of them in the same way with the same diagnostic tools, analytical tools?
I think there are more similarities than maybe you'd think, but there are also more differences. When I first started working on terrorism, we didn't really divide up the world. Now, what's really exciting is that there are enough people working on terrorism that it really, frankly, wouldn't make sense to study jihadis without speaking Arabic. I ended up studying terrorism around the world. There were far too many languages for me to learn all of them. But today there are people who specialize in terrorists and speak Indonesian and speak Urdu and speak Arabic. But this is how I started. And I guess I would say that I speak terrorism. I've done enough of this work that the narratives are often very familiar. So even if I don't speak the language, I speak the language of terrorism.
One of the things you've been working on lately at the Pardee School at Boston University is a project on evaluating community safety and health challenges for reintegration programs in the United States. And what you're looking at are people convicted of terrorism-related crimes and the issue of reintegrating them. And you and I have talked about this in the past. It's rather a fascinating project. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Sure. So the project involves a developmental evaluation of how probation officers are thinking about reintegrating people convicted of terrorism-related crimes, and also how the releasees think about what aspects of that effort to help them reintegrate is most effective. We've interviewed over 40 federal probation officers. We're about to start interviewing state probation officers. We've also interviewed, I think, about 16 releasees. We try, when possible, to match the releasee with the probation officer so that we get to hear what works and what doesn't work from both sides. Well, one thing we've heard from the releasees is random acts of kindness were really fundamental to their de-radicalizing. The probation officers don't get involved in de-radicalizing anyone. People are allowed to have whatever opinion they like to have. They just can't be violent in the name of that perspective. But the releasees we've talked to often consider themselves to be de-radicalized. They've de-radicalized themselves. And that's fascinating to hear what made them turn away from their earlier extremist views. Sometimes it's rapport with the probation officer. That's an incredibly moving thing to hear. Sometimes it is that random act of kindness. It's an FBI agent who is surprisingly nice. It's a prison officer. For one person, it was working in the kitchen. Some of these stories are so moving. A very young man who really, and you really see how this kid just fell into, this was a jihadi, how he just fell into something. He was groomed, and it was a really big mistake, but he really was de-radicalized by a cook in the prison more than anything else. Establishing a good relationship with this cook who really cared about him, trying to do the best possible job he could, was really healing to him. What I love about this project is that we're getting to see something wonderful happening, which is that people really can change. They can make mistakes in life, as we all do, and then they can change.
There's a narrative of prison as a radicalizing environment, right? And we read about this in Europe particularly. But what you're describing is prison as a potentially de-radicalizing environment. It's interesting.
Yes, prisons can be radicalizing environments, of course. And that has happened again and again in Europe. Mm-hmm. There are many cases like that. So far, the releasees that we've interviewed are not examples of that. I know they exist, but the examples that I have so far, pretty small n, it's a very different picture. It really is people de-radicalizing, either in some cases before prison, even before they get there, in some cases in prison.
In February, you published a piece on the trend towards authoritarianism for Foreign Policy magazine. It was co-authored with Karen Stenner, and it was titled, I just want to read this for our listeners, How to Live with Authoritarians. Democracies have to learn how to manage some people's innate fears of change. And I was struck reading this, but also by the title about your and Karen Stenner's notion of fears of change and what that means. You know, we're living in a century where the changes are so vast and so fast that it is a major issue that we need to look at. And yet there isn't that much tension to change. It's more like, what are the threats? What's destabilizing it? So I wanted to talk about what the two of you meant by fear of change and how you see that as affecting these emergent authoritarian regimes.
Karen Stenner is really one of the world's leading experts on authoritarianism. And she talks about it as almost like an allergy to diversity. We're talking not about authoritarian leaders, actually. We're talking about a latent tendency in every population around the world. About 30% of that population has trouble with diversity, diversity of thought, diversity of ethics, diversity of gender, and especially diversity of race or ethnicity. And when there is so much diversity, when there's a rapid change in the demographics of our country, or a lot of immigration, rapid immigration has happened with all the Syrian refugees coming into Europe, for example. It is a trigger for people with that latent tendency, which is actually measurable in part from how they choose to raise their children. But it's a tendency that is at least 50% heritable, according to twin studies. So I think it's a really interesting way to look at why we might see this extraordinary increase in antipathy to migration, to immigration, and overt racism. I mean, obviously, President Trump made it okay to express racist views that may have been unexpressed before, but I think there really has been an increase. And according to Stenner's work, the reason for that would be that people who were latent authoritarians, suddenly the diversity in the United States is too much for them to bear, and they become much more openly racist and anti-immigrant.
So there's a number of things that are really interesting about this kind of description that you've given. One is the use of authoritarian for the people, right? Not for leaders, as you referred to at the beginning, which is an interesting use and not one that we're used to. We see other terms like fascism and things like that. Interesting. And I think it's important to point to your use of the term authoritarian. The second thing is it raises the question of, is there an economic issue here? Is the racism and the dislike of the other, the antipathy for the other, solvable by addressing the resources? I mean, there's a sense of, you know, oh, they're going to take our jobs, like we hear about the southern border in the United States, or is it not addressable like that? Because what we've seen in the United States is the rise of white identity extremists who are not have-nots, you know, who are not excluded from necessarily from jobs, education, et cetera. So is there no economic component of this that could be used in the way we would have talked about, let's say, radicalization elsewhere in the world? Like, can we take care of these individuals economically, make sure they have the things they need to sustain themselves and potentially thrive?
I think that there's a lot of research, not mine, suggesting that it's not really about economics, but a sense of status loss. I've talked to so many terrorists, I tend to eventually get around to understanding their feelings. I mean, I first started asking them about feelings because I didn't want to look like an intelligence operative. That was my strategy. But now I'm extremely interested in it. And one of the things that has always come out is this feeling of humiliation. It's such an important part of a grievance, I think, that, you know, you hear the story about why the terrorists are active, but if you push further and further, eventually you get to status loss or humiliation. And this, a search for redressing that, to find a way to reestablish dignity. Obviously, this is a really bad idea. It's not an effective way. But I do think that part of what we're seeing now is really about status loss, much more than it is about economic factors. As of 2013, more non-white babies than white babies were born. And by 2043, America will be minority-majority country. That is obviously a major trigger for some Americans.
And yet, when we talk about status loss, you know, what is that really about? Status loss meaning wanting to be at the top, right? Wanting to be at the top of some ladder. Is there any referent point in history, or even any referent point in the contemporary moment that you can point to and say, here's how to address this expression of worries about status loss? Has there been any attempts to address this or not?
Diana Mutz has done this really interesting work on status loss, showing that that's the key factor, but she hasn't given us a recipe for what to do. I've never seen anyone propose a policy remedy for this problem. I mean, I think we're beginning to understand the importance of status loss, and I don't know what the answer is. That is a really important question. It's very clear to me over time that feelings are really essential here, even though it might seem not of interest to people who think about national security, how people feel, but I think it should be of interest. If I look at the individuals that we've talked to who became violent extremists, what made them feel better, according to what they tell us, it is finding productive work. That is part of it. It is often finding a sense of purpose in some other area that they didn't expect. There's one former jihadi who, interestingly, became extremely interested in animal rights. In fact, obsessed with animal rights, so much so that we wondered if this person is sort of a natural zealot. You see a lot of people who come out of violent extremist backgrounds and now want to set up shop to help de-radicalize people. And they can be as committed to that effort to de-radicalize others as they were to radicalizing others.
So the search for a cause.
The search for a cause, it seems to be really good medicine to find, well, the significant—
a constructive cause.
Ari Kuglansky and his co-authors, I love the way he puts this, the quest for significance. That would seem to be medicine if we're talking about individuals, you know, at the level of individuals. Finding some significance, something different from the area where the significance was lost, finding some new way of feeling significant.
Before we go, we should probably talk about your book, My War Criminal.
Okay.
Your conversations with Radovan Karadzic, which has been a somewhat controversial book. Just to remind our listeners, you know, Radovan Karadzic was the person we identify with the massacre of Srebrenica. And I'm just sort of curious, now that it's out and it's behind you, what are your takeaways from the experience?
Well, I deeply offended the Bosniak community, and they really organized against the book. And one even admitted in print that he organized a campaign against me, not just the book. And I incredibly foolishly did not recognize the extent to which I could re-traumatize that community. And I do think that's probably part of the explanation. I thought I was writing about someone that everybody knew was a really evil man. I mean, that was my starting point. I didn't think I needed to explain that. So what else? It's actually a very emotional topic for me.
No, that's why I wanted to give you a chance to sort of talk about it. I mean, I think it was it's such an interesting thing to do and put in the context of your life's work and your life's curiosity, which is what motivates these people? Who are they? I just thought it was very interesting. And I just wondered how it had resonated with you in terms of being that close to somebody who you describe as an evil man and, you know, a mass murderer responsible for genocide. And I was just kind of wondering how it sat with you after spending that kind of time with him, which you do explain in the book a bit.
It was extremely painful to go back to the interviews. I use empathetic listening. That's my technique. And as a result, I have been accused of being pro-jihadi, believe it or not, pro-neo-Nazi.
In other words, empathy is confused with sympathy.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And much to my surprise, I was accused of being pro-Radovan Karadzic, even though by the end of the book, I'm comparing him with Nazis quite explicitly. And yet it's also a process. I really wanted to explain what was appealing about him. He would be very ineffective if there was nothing appealing about him. I mean, it's like the story of Little Red Riding Hood. How does the wolf get her? He looks like grandma. And how do charismatic, malevolent nationalist leaders draw people to them? Because they're able to project something appealing. They're able to say that they're going to solve people's problem, but do it in a persuasive way. And I wanted to explain that. And unfortunately, I think some people, probably because of trauma, from my perspective, misconstrued what I intended to do. I actually think it's my best book, but there, obviously, I'm not in good company. So.
You work in a field where, you know, there's a lot of unhappiness, discontent, fear, anger, hatred. What brings you hope?
I will say that the project that you asked me about really does give me hope. I mean, I think when you see people who commit terrible crimes, who really fall down the rabbit hole of hatred and are able to come back from that, it is so inspiring because we all make mistakes and we all want to get better. And when you see such a dramatic shift, it's powerful.
It's very interesting because while we watch all of these exchanges, interchanges, sociological analysis, political analysis, your sort of insistence on let's talk about the feelings, you know, that are, is underneath it all, is actually a very important piece, I think, of the larger discussion. So Jessica Stern, thank you so much for sharing your insights, your thoughts, your reflections with us today on Vital Interest Podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast. In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interest online forum at CenterOnNationalSecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.